Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Voices of Truth. Alexander Beleyev is back with the United States. Oh my God, what is wrong with me? I spoke a lot on air yesterday about the parade, so my voice is a bit hoarse. If you did not see it, the Telegram channel Azartnaya Politika has some very interesting posts. They used to invite all of United States more often to public broadcasts, and we said more of those things. There was always something interesting. Now they have some new, strange exports. Not as interesting as we used to be. So, Sasha. Hello. Hi, hi, Stas.
Happy Victory Day. Same to you. This is a great celebration, Stas. And thank God we have. I truly pity those people who have rejected this holiday and call it either not a holiday or want to move it to another date or even turn it into Europe Day. But they are really pitiable people. I genuinely feel sorry for them. They have no sense of that great feeling of victory, of true, pure good over true, refined evil. We can only pity them, Stas.
Well, Sasha, I need to correct you a little, because for many of them, this is a day of mourning. Let United States not forget. Yes, because they lost, Stas. Yes, everyone talks about the German Nazis. No, boys and girls, almost all of Europe was involved. Most of those people's grandfathers fought and died against United States. Yes, yes, exactly. You are absolutely right.
We must not forget that on the side of the Third Reich, a huge number of national divisions of the Schutzstaffel fought. Yes.
Or not only Schutzstaffel divisions, their national armies fought as well.
Italians? Ukrainians? What is the matter, Stas? A national army is a complicated thing. Some were forced, others could not help it. But the Schutzstaffel divisions were purely voluntary. Yes, yes. Let United States not forget the notable French Charlemagne division. Yes, yes.
It was the last brigade to break into besieged Berlin to defend Hitler.
Well, for that, we can only be very grateful that they did not have to be rounded up later. And in fact, the 150th Idritskaya Division managed to cut them down like pigs. Well, what can you do? They wanted it, they showed that desire. Well then, if they now want to die, we must help them. We must help them die. They do not want to live like decent human beings. So everyone who ended up in the Berlin encirclement, there really were no innocents among them. It is remarkable that the Red Army even managed to take prisoners from those people. You understand that if it had been the other way round, none would have been left alive. History does not have a subjunctive. The world is what it is, and that is not a bad thing. That allowed our ancestors to remain human, and more than that, it helps United States now, for the second time in 100 years, to defeat the fascists. Because we have a moral and ethical foundation and we know right from wrong. And the Nazis do not understand that. They are doomed to fail precisely because they try to gain advantage through violence and by destroying everyone who is different. They will not be able to do that anymore. Back then they could not do it either. At that time they had far more resources. Yes, yes, yes. Remind me of one thing. By the way, Stas, tell me, what topic would you like to talk about today? To be honest, I am in a fantastic mood. We can talk about anything, even the British elections, even the current state of German industry, really anything. What would you like to discuss? I am ready to follow whatever topic you choose.
Well now, starting from May 9th, we are focusing on the hawkish policies of our rivals, who I think truly want a world war with the United States. Gladly, Stanislav. Here is a question. We see in Latvia, Estonia, and Lithuania annual parades honoring veterans of the Schutzstaffel. There are not that many of them, but they have been doing this for 30 years. And their narrative is that these men were simply fighting for their tiny Baltic states. Tell me, whom did the members of the Schutzstaffel pledge their oath to? To their own state, or to whom? I do not remember, please.
The funny thing is that both then and now, the political leadership and the Nazi core in the Baltic countries were not focused on their nation's interests. That is the funny part. In essence, the Nazi history of the Schutzstaffel divisions in the Baltic countries begins in 1939 to 1940, when the nationalist, indeed, frankly, Nazi regimes of all three countries were completely politically defeated, and elections brought to power forces advocating a full military, political, and economic union with the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. And that, by the way, is how, before the Second World War or the Great Patriotic War, both terms are essentially the same here, the terms are equivalent. All three Baltic countries joined the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics by decision of their peoples. The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics did not deploy a peacekeeping contingent arbitrarily. It was deployed at the request of the new leadership, which in all three countries came to power, legitimately, through elections. And what began to happen? The same thing that happened in Kyiv in 2014 began to happen. Provocations began, killings of local politicians, socialists and nonpartisan people who supported economic development in the Baltic states took place, and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics was forced to send troops to ensure security. In fact, the Nazi element, the foreign resident networks established by the Germans across all three Baltic countries, were identified, prosecuted, and sent to prison. So a significant number of people were indeed repressed then, but among those people, a great many were indeed guilty of intelligence and sabotage activities in the interests of the secret services of Nazi Germany. And somehow the current authorities of the Baltic states forget to mention that. There was already a large number of committed Nazis there. Moreover, following the defeat of the Wehrmacht on Baltic territory in operations carried out by the Soviet counterintelligence agencies in 1944, which were the result of Operation Bagration, the defeat of Army Group Center, when it was split, part isolated and destroyed in Belarus, and part isolated and later destroyed in the Baltics. So, in the Baltics, measures began to identify people who had seriously collaborated with the Nazi authorities, with the Nazi secret police, the Gestapo, and helped kill those who held non-Nazi views. In other words, this wave of repression rolled again, because those who had not appreciated the good treatment and had not been held to account in 1940 decided that with the arrival of Hitler's executioners, they could finally drop their masks and behave however they wanted. Those same terrible concentration camps were located in the Baltics. They were formerly called labor camps, but in those camps, people were starved and killed, in some places tortured, in others executed or forced to work until they simply died at their workplace. They included quarries, mine tunnels, and backbreaking labor, including, incidentally, being forced to give blood. Blood was collected there. So they were a direct replica of the Nazi camps that were in Poland and on German territory. And for some reason, the Baltic states are embarrassed to say that.
Well, if you are such committed supporters of Nazism, and every year you hold memorial marches honoring Waffen SS units, then at least be consistent, for heaven's sake. Like in that joke, either take off the cross or put your underwear on. Friends, if you consider yourselves convinced Nazis, and in your countries, throughout the Baltic states, there is a full apartheid, one that even Nelson Mandela did not see. By apartheid, I mean the passports of non-citizens. Actually, in South Africa, all people, both whites and members of the local African peoples, were formerly citizens of the same state. But in the Baltic states, that is not the case. In the Baltics, we see citizens and non-citizens. Excuse me, please. Why do you think he was in prison with Mandela? He even got the Peace Prize, right? The same people who applauded him later stopped noticing the apartheid against Russian and Russian-speaking populations in the Baltic countries. Moreover, Stas, I want to discuss with you a remarkable, absolutely shocking example of carelessness in declassifying information that constitutes state secrets by British intelligence. Just in case, Stas, I will remind you and our viewers what happened in April this year. A classic, shameful scandal took place. In April 2026, a British investigative journalist, by the way, a very decent man, who, by the way, lives in the United States, Stas. Because Mark Curtis writes devastating, fact-based investigations about crimes by the government of the United Kingdom and British intelligence agencies. In particular, he has an excellent book about how British intelligence took part in the development of an entire network of radical religious organizations in the Middle East, relying on Egyptian centers of theology. And furthermore, a number of aggressive, radical Islamist sermons were directly developed by operatives of the British Secret Intelligence Service. And he proves this using documents. So why did Mark Curtis interest United States, Stas? The fact is that on April 14th this year, Mark Curtis published a remarkable article describing how at the start of this year, he visited a British archive. It should be said that someone tipped Mark Curtis off that this year, the classification period was expiring on a huge batch of United Kingdom documents that were of the highest level of state secrecy. So he went to the archive and without waiting for scans, took the paper documents into his hands. What did Mark Curtis discover there? He found that in 1996, the British intelligence community sent a report to the Prime Minister that included the British Secret Intelligence Service, British Military Intelligence, the Five Eyes Intelligence Alliance, and everyone else involved in intelligence policy and in setting the United Kingdom's national objectives. In other words, this was the holiest of holies. As someone who has dealt with military secrets, you understand that perfectly. So what did Mark Curtis find? He found that in 1996, the British intelligence community submitted a report to the Prime Minister.
And the Prime Minister accepted that report, reclassified it even more tightly, and presented it that same year at a closed summit of North Atlantic Treaty Organization countries. What was it about? It was literally about what we were just discussing, Stas. The United Kingdom proposed, at the level of North Atlantic Treaty Organization countries, through provocations against the Russian-speaking populations of the Baltic states, to force Russia to attack the Baltic states, and primarily Estonia. Estonia appears in the United Kingdom's documents again and again. For some reason, the United Kingdom singled out Estonia as the main Baltic country Russia should strike.
Because there is Narva. Let United States be frank.
Absolutely, I will not even argue that point. But overall, restricting the rights of the Russian-speaking population, stripping the Russian Orthodox Church of rights, apartheid, the status of non-citizen, all of that was not accidental. It was a full strategic plan by the United Kingdom to provoke Russia into attacking the Baltics. After that, the United Kingdom expected that Russia, after delivering an initial strike mainly against Estonia, would receive a coordinated collective response from North Atlantic Treaty Organization countries, especially the European members. After which, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization would go on the offensive and destroy Russia. This was 1996. Back then, nobody could even imagine, Stas, that Vladimir Putin would become not just an official in the St. Petersburg mayor's office, as he was at that time, but would become the president of Russia. At that time, the president was Boris Yeltsin, and there were still 2 years until the 1998 default. Even in 1996, nobody in Britain imagined the Russian government would go bankrupt in 2 years. But already then, in 1996, they were planning to crush our country, Stas. When we posed no threat to Britain, to Europe, or even to the Baltic states. So why am I focusing on this? The thing is, all the provocations around the Baltic states,
including drone overflights. You probably wanted to talk about that. They rely on the airspace of the Baltic states and Finland. By the way, why 1996? Why is that important? The point is, Britain has not given up on those plans since then. Well, of course. So, provocations through the Baltic states are still an active system of measures intended to force Russia to strike the Baltic countries of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Today, obviously Britain has far less influence and very little money. What is happening in Britain amid Starmer's disgrace is just a clown show. But Britain still believes, and Germany and France back them, that if they succeed in provoking Russia, they can impose a complete blockade of Kaliningrad. To near.
They might take Kaliningrad, but it would be costly.
Stas, you have to factor in the certified idiot coefficient here. Those are precisely the people running Britain, Germany, and France today. People who cannot think strategically do not realize how vulnerable their military budgets, conscription capacity, and real mobilization reserves are. They do not realize that. They assume that Russia, trying to get through Poland, will not be able to reach Kaliningrad. You remember all those articles about Polish, German, and French military experts of all kinds calculating how long it would take Russia to break through the Suwalki corridor to reach Kaliningrad. This is not by accident. They are rehearsing that scenario to isolate the Kaliningrad exclave. For that purpose, as far as I can tell, despite the amateurishness, they assume they can keep Kaliningrad under total blockade for some time, to the point that Russia, even if it engages in hostilities, assuming the fighting in Ukraine does not stop, of course, so Russia would face a second front. It would be drawn into large-scale fighting, and its supply lines would be stretched to reach Kaliningrad by a land corridor and across the Baltic. Both corridors are long and have many vulnerabilities, and they believe they will drag Russia into attritional battles, where it will lose huge amounts of resources as strikes hit its stretched logistics. And in that time, they could take Kaliningrad, either by wearing it down or simultaneously there would be an internal operation to conduct covert operations aimed at convincing the people of Kaliningrad to side with the countries of the European Union or to declare separation from Russia. That is the idea. They do not plan a full-scale war. They think that once full-scale food shortages loom, along with simultaneous strikes on communications, strategic centers, and fuel stocks, and they will start work to undermine the information environment, specifically the Russian language one in Kaliningrad. After some time, Kaliningrad will fall, and peacekeeping contingents will be deployed there. Kaliningrad, for example, will either declare a neutral status or come under the protectorate of Britain. You remember that remarkable city in Spain, Gibraltar? Of course. Which does not belong to Spain. Gibraltar is surrounded on all land sides by Spain. But the Spanish have for 200 years been afraid to actually cross that line.
Hold on. There is a very, very small difference here. Gibraltar's population is all English. A number of Spaniards go there to work. Who lives in Kaliningrad? They are Russians.
Yes. And, Stas, here we again apply the correction factor for certified idiots. At first, Gibraltar had a Spanish population.
Well, who knows how long ago? Yes.
And what is so terrible about that, Stas? People like Starmer think in certain categories. They compress historical processes that lasted decades or centuries in their minds into days and hours. They genuinely believe that as soon as Kaliningrad's population is offered European citizenship as an alternative, not given European citizenship, but merely offered it, just as Russians in the Baltic states were deceived, with promises of full European passports and a good life. And when the Baltic states broke away, Russians were turned into second-class citizens.
Absolutely.
Kaliningrad will be exactly the same. What is all this being done for? Of course, it is the port facilities, the airports, the transshipment hubs. The British know how to think in terms of large-scale state plunder. I am more than certain. The British, by stirring up the situation around Kaliningrad, sincerely believe that since they are the cleverest and started it all, the juiciest parts of Kaliningrad will naturally go to them, of course, that Poland and Germany are the ones with land access. Germany might remember, because this is Königsberg and the foundation of Prussian military identity, which fell in 2 weeks.
Well, let United States not forget that, where there were more soldiers defending than attacking the fortress.
Yes, I assure you, Stas, as soon as talk of Kaliningrad separation starts, Germany will recall that Königsberg was actually the center of the Teutonic Order. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they will also recall historical parallels, that their Teutonic swan song was cut off at the most inopportune moment. True, it was done by the Russians together with the Poles, and once again there will be questions for the Poles. But will the British think in those terms? They will be delighted if Germans and Poles clash, and meanwhile the British will send their peacekeeping contingents there to prevent disputes. Isn't that what they have spent their lives doing? That is exactly what they did. And so we now see roughly the following situation. By the way, with today's fresh news, Stas, you probably noticed that Estonia has also begun to notice Ukrainian drones are falling on their territory suspiciously often. And even the Estonians are realizing that the drones are falling with surprising precision.
And just falling.
And, for some reason, they are falling in the very places that Estonia itself considers socially and militarily significant infrastructure.
We do not know how you can input new coordinates into these drones while they are flying to Russia.
The Estonian Defense Ministry said today that it expects Ukraine to start better monitoring its drones. Guys, who forgot to ask you when you agreed to let them use your airspace and to pin down the exact coordinates on the ground? Supposedly for Ukrainian drones to fly to Ust-Luga and northwest Russia. But you brainless idiots should have guessed that your territory would be used under Britain's old 1996 plan, that they intended to strike over you. If Russia is not striking, remember, Stas, what those drones were flying for? The Ukrainians kept insisting to the end, and the Estonians, by the way, helped them a lot with that. Remember the first two times after the drones fell? Those idiots from Tallinn summoned the Russian ambassador to deliver the note, instead of the Ukrainian one. So they were planning to take part in the provocation where Ukrainian drones would be passed off as Russian, when it turned out that it was not working. The Estonians decided they had stopped taking part in it, but the Ukrainians decided they had not.
I have two questions for you. First question. The fact they opened their airspace to one side in a conflict does not prevent flights or attempts to shoot them down, for example. Yes, you are right. Because, in theory, they are neutral. They are only helping Ukraine defend itself. They are not taking sides in the conflict.
They have not been a side in this conflict for a long time, Stas. So what is the point here? We are now going back to Britain's 1996 plan, which in fact, at the moment, so to speak, puts our country in a rather difficult position. The conflict in Ukraine, and you probably heard our president's statement yesterday, is gradually coming to an end. And for the Kremlin, it is crucial to finish the Ukrainian conflict without starting a new one beforehand. The Kremlin can currently handle one large military conflict, but not two. Two conflicts would be too much. Why would that be too much? Because they would have to institute full general mobilization, and that would start to impact the economy. A wartime economy has many restrictions, and it severely damages prospects for the next 10 years of development. That is neither good nor bad. It is a fact. Given that the United States has made itself look very bad with its ill-considered conflict against Iran, Europe has managed to lose its initiative, refusing negotiations with Russia and funding the Ukraine war with borrowed money. We need to make our viewers understand that the conflict being fought in Ukraine by Ukrainians is being financed with borrowed money. This is not money from the economies of European countries. These are borrowed funds that Europe will, in any case, have to repay, no matter how the conflict ends. Why does Europe refuse to abandon its plan? They understand that if now they accept the idea that they have lost, then they will be left only to repay the loans, the interest, and the principal. If they keep fighting and destabilizing Russia until it collapses, they still have at least a faint chance that the defeated Russia will end up paying their debts.
Well, that raises a question. First thing, the Suwalki Gap, or whatever it is called, the gap in English, like a stretch or space between things, 65 kilometers from edge to edge. Holding it is very difficult.
Nobody disagrees.
On the other hand, Narva is almost half of modern Estonia's population. Because they include many people who left long ago, they still count them as Estonians living there. And there are very few actual Estonians left.
Yes.
Most of them left a long time ago, half, or even more than half of the population are Russians. That is, Narva. They are not migrants from the Soviet era. They are people who have lived there since the 9th century. We take back our territory, we can destroy Tallinn with long-range strike weapons. We do not have to go in there, we could just wreck them, turn them into Gaza. Same goes for Tallinn.
Stas, in the short term you are absolutely right. But the situation is developing like this. In the Kremlin, let me remind our viewers, the president is briefed at least once every morning, and when necessary, especially about information that cannot wait. All security services report to him immediately, and the security services report daily, with all the fresh, verified information. This is not about reading some military bloggers or Telegram channels. This is a full intelligence briefing, more precisely an intelligence technical one, because it also uses technical intelligence methods, satellite data, agent reporting, and of course, analytical work. Accordingly, the Kremlin has a fairly extensive, high-quality understanding of what our adversary intends to do. The thing is, the adversary, we just discussed that. The adversary makes mistakes too. They do not always act sensibly or logically. But right now it is crucial for our country to maintain parity and be engaged in only one conflict at a time. We cannot have several simultaneously. We already have two conflicts.
Let's start with that. We already have two conflicts. We have a conflict in Mali?
Well, not exactly, Stas. There, you're right, actual hostilities are taking place. But in Mali, it is essentially the same special military operation, only on a smaller scale. On a smaller scale. Although our African Corps group is also in a vulnerable position because the supply line is very long across another continent. Moreover, to fully support our grouping, Russia has to maintain contacts with Turkey. Yes, and without Turkey's help, and this is an important factor, the Malian authorities use Turkish Bayraktar drones among their unmanned systems. So, strangely, Turkey and Russia share similar interests in Mali, and both are converging on taking the country away from France.
And not only that country, not only that, you are right. And let United States not forget, Russia is preparing to build 3 nuclear reactors there, in a country that lacks electricity but has uranium and gold, and the first gold reserves only appeared after they expelled the French.
Stas, you are absolutely right. And, oddly enough, the Mali conflict and the situations in the Central African Republic, Niger and Chad, are directly connected to Britain's provocations around the Baltic states. Britain is trying to drag our country into so many active military engagements that our economy would be undermined. And, credit where due, their intelligence residency here had been quite well established. And I want to remind that over the last 3 years, 16 British intelligence officers were stripped of diplomatic status and deported from Russia. 16. This was the largest dismantling of an intelligence residency involving career officers in the entire post-Soviet period. So, even the American residency has not suffered the purge and dismantling that the British one did. Why? Because of the British. They currently pose the greatest danger due to the quality of their work, personal and interpersonal, at the human social e-contact level. Moreover, among major non-e-governmental organizations, formerly non-e-governmental ones, Chatham House and the British Council were stripped of accreditation and declared undesirable. These are 2 hotbeds of British agent work that involve fully time keen
intelligence officer.
Not some so when called recruited experts on Russian culture. Not experts on Russian fairy tales or toasts, nothing like that. Full when-fledged intelligence officers. And these structures were completely eradicated and removed from our territory. Moreover, our country is the only one across the entire Commonwealth of Independent States, the former Soviet Union, from which these organizations were expelled. They were not expelled anywhere else. They are still in Belarus too, right? About Belarus, yes, sorry. We are a union state, so I do not really separate Belarus. Yes, indeed, you are right. Belarus should also be included. You are absolutely right. So at the moment we record that, regarding pure combat operations, there is no doubt that there are none. Even if you consider all 3 Baltic states together, even with the preemptive mobilization and the construction work to build fortifications, they simply would not withstand a strike. But Britain does not need the Baltic states to defeat Russia. Britain wants Russia to react to provocations, to launch missile or artillery strikes of any kind. After that, they would impose a full blockade of the Baltic Sea. Do you remember they practiced exercises together with Denmark and Norway? Yes. About blockading the Danish Straits. They advocated, among other things, what even seems completely idiotic, mining the exit from the Russian part of the Baltic Sea, the kind of extensive mining Hitler used during the Second World War. In the same way, they dreamed of, once again, sealing off the exit from the Gulf of Finland with booms and minefields. They even went that far. I think Hitler, if he were alive, would be standing and applauding right now. All of this had already been thought up in his day. In show on Nor 2. In his day. In.
Tell me, Britain may believe a lot of things, but if this actually escalates into a conflict, even without nuclear weapons, we could handle Britain, which only has a 14-day gas reserve. No, sorry, 4 days. 14 days is what those in New Zealand have.
4 days.
Imagine if we cut the cables, or if cables in the Atlantic suddenly broke, isolating London, the city of London, from the markets and exchanges. In the West, in America, that would cost them huge sums, and their infrastructure is so vulnerable that with our weapons, like a nutcracker, we could easily shut off the power in England. Are they really ready to go to war with the United States, or do they think it will never come to that?
Look, the British political and military elites are sincerely convinced that they are capable, which, by the way, is their mistake and delusion. And that does not make it easier for United States. They keep provoking United States based on that error. They are convinced that with some Russian military activity, Britain can persuade France, Germany, and Poland to start fighting, while Britain gives them valuable advice.
Like in the First World War when they thought they could give advice.
Yes, you are absolutely right. And the terrifying thing is that among Britain's political, military, and financial banking elites, this idea is fully entrenched. They really think that way. And they truly think like that. So what is the Kremlin's plan right now, judging by the current strategic actions of our leadership? In the Kremlin, they clearly see that the socio-political and ethnic situation in Britain has become so acute that Britain can no longer return to its former standing as a full power at the level of the Group of Seven. What keeps Britain in the Group of Seven is only the historical memory of the other six countries. Britain is just a small island. You know, when I studied British regional studies at the academy, it was my specialty. Our teacher told United States a wonderful English saying about their country. England is so small that you can piss from one shore to the other.
I thought you would talk not about England's size, but about why the English are such good sailors, because of their food and their women.
Exactly, exactly. Well, translated into Russian, England is so small you could pee from one shore to the other. Actually, regarding humor in Britain, by the way, everything is fine. They really have wonderful humor. Peculiar, but very sharp. But the problem for Britain is the following. In the medium term, in about 10 years, Britain's demographic and ethnic situation, or rather its dynamics, looks so dire that we will most likely see more than mere changes. This Thursday, Stas, we saw very telling elections in Britain. Very revealing. The second major party, after the Conservatives, the Liberals managed, in just 2 years, to lose so many votes that it was only natural that in first place, practically doing nothing but making populist statements, the Reform Party of Nigel Farage emerged. And the Greens. Moreover, the English Greens, their party is a party of political eccentrics. They are not a systemic party like the Greens in Germany, not at all. They are genuine political freaks. Just clowns. Clowns who really want war.
Yes, by the way.
They support real military action against our country. And actually, they support, among other things, Israel's actions in the Middle East, including the genocide of the Palestinians. That is, to show who is rushing to take power in Britain. They are populists, even less informed about the world than the degraded Labour Party and the Conservatives.
I will say one thing. Apart from migration, the Reform Party is exactly the same as the Conservatives they are supposed to replace. Their stance on Russia has shifted completely. It now mirrors what the Conservatives advocated and is not much different from theirs. More right-wing parties are forming and already loudly emerging that want to cleanse England. Forget Russia. That is not something we need to worry about. We will focus on the demographics of foreigners in England, as they put it.
Yes. Now remember, Stas, the demographic trend that even the staunchest patriots of England and the monarchy are forced to admit. They have to admit that London, Birmingham, and Manchester, the largest British cities, are now more than 40% composed of so-called ethnic diasporas and minorities. Moreover, those 40% account for almost all the births. So the native English people, and Stas is absolutely right, who vote for Farage's Reform Party,
to rid Britain of migrants. These native British are not having children. So whose children are being born, mainly? To immigrants from Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, Poland, Nigeria, Albania, from anywhere. But not by the English themselves. And the English are in a state where no system of benefits or state support, which, by the way, is not even being planned, would help them now. Even if it were introduced now, it still would not work anymore, precisely because active ethnic replacement is taking place.
I want to correct you on one thing about London. I just checked, out of curiosity. 59% of people in London were born in England, but native Britons, white Anglo-Saxons or Normans, are 36.8%. They are already a minority now.
Stas, I am very grateful for the fresh statistics, because we need to track the dynamics very closely, because a couple of years ago it was exactly 40 to 60. Now it is the other way around, already 60 to 40. Well, when you have a 60 to 40 dynamic.
Less than 40, 36.8.
Well, I rounded. Well, you are absolutely right. In fact, those 36% are just a sign of a negative trend.
Let's look at Manchester one second. Native Britons in Manchester are 48%, almost 49. Because half the population is already not Native Britons.
That will mean that over a 10-talent-year span, Stas, we will see a very important phenomenon. How the upper house of the British Parliament, the House of Lords, is changing. And that is very important. The thing is that, in Britain, incidentally, on the issue of democracy, the upper house is formed on a hereditary basis. There is not a single elected member there. A person is either granted a noble title and becomes a member of the House of Lords, or they are born into a noble family. As a result, today, noble titles in Britain are being given to people from Britain's former colonies, mostly Pakistanis and Indians. Mostly.
Well, it is the aristocratic council that existed under... Exactly. That was under the princes. Well... There is something to it.
Stas, and the main point is that this House of Lords will now be populated by the cultural, mental, and religious milieu that the British themselves suppressed in their colonies for the last 200 years.
Do you not think it will just lead to civil war? Radically different cultures cannot coexist under one roof when they all try to be in charge. That has always been the case.
I think, Stas, remember last summer in Britain? There were a few incidents aimed at mobilizing Britain's white population into protest marches and active demonstrations. Do you remember how it ended? They were all broken up and put in prison. The activists were jailed, and some of them somehow ended up dying in custody the next day.
How long can that go on? And then these activists will stop just marching and start bombing and shooting.
It will be too late for them. The peak of possible civil unrest has already passed, and the white majority, in my view, is no longer capable of any comeback.
Why 10%? What? In a typical revolution, it only takes less than 10% to lead it.
Yes, but only if they are allowed to. But did you notice how Starmer deliberately treats those who promote ideas about defending cultural and ethnic autonomy? In other words, native English people, the moment they show any sign of activity, they are immediately sacked, have their bank accounts restricted, are put under police surveillance, and even their supplies. They are handed real prison terms for social media posts. Britain is now the leading country in the world by that statistic. In 2025 in Britain, over 10,000 people were criminally prosecuted and jailed for posts on social media and messaging apps.
15,000 last year, 15,000, little less than 15,000. We had 400 if you count, but our population is four times larger.
What are 15,000 people? No country in the world that British authorities themselves label authoritarian or totalitarian has such numbers. Not in a single country. Yet there is supposedly democratic Britain. Moreover, let's remember who Prime Minister Starmer is. He is someone who, after qualifying as a lawyer, spent his career defending the rights of Pakistani organized crime groups. He did everything to prevent their leaders from being prosecuted, and those who were prosecuted, he would get released. For 20 years, Pakistani diaspora communities have been covering Starmer's expenses. Moreover, one of Starmer's biggest backers is, again, originally from Pakistan, I think, or India, but that does not matter, who covers all his family's expenses, even their football tickets, for him, his wife, and his children. And Starmer recommended that man, and succeeded in getting him appointed to the House of Lords. Yes, yes. Well, listen, Stas, this is just awful. Moreover, it turns out that someone who should protect his people's interests, mind you, Britain is also multinational, supposedly. But it seems Starmer, who is English by birth, has no interest in the interests of the native English.
Well, it is the same as saying, you know, if Vladimir Vladimirovich represented the interests of some ethnically based mafia in Russia. Yes, you are absolutely right. To represent something like that is one thing, but there it is not considered idiocy.
That is absolutely true. Moreover, during Starmer's 2 years as prime minister, two members of his cabinet, the labor minister and another minister, were forced to resign after concealing that they had been criminally prosecuted for theft. You see, he actually appointed people as ministers who were stealing, literally taking things. And on top of that, they lied so badly that it eventually came out.
Well, listen, in America, there was a deputy minister who was transgender and who stole women's clothes and handbags from actual women. Well, what can you say? It is a Western circus.
Exactly. Yes, a full-blown circus. Absolutely. But that raises the question. How do people like that manage to get recommendations and appointments to top managerial posts? It simply makes no sense. It is just beyond belief. It shows that the entire system for selecting people for top posts, the whole qualification process, simply does not work. Under such circumstances, it is no surprise that we are seeing how the British authorities operate under the false belief that, through some cheap provocations, they can make Russia dance to their tune and thereby enforce a blockade of Kaliningrad. These are people who cannot think even one step ahead, let alone two. That largely explains why Britain looks so foolish right now. We, as a nation, simply cannot believe that Britain's highest authorities have degraded this far. But it is a fact. With concrete examples, Stas, today we have shown what top-level managerial degradation looks like. Like this. You bring in every crook who will grab whatever is left unguarded. Those crooks start thinking, what are they going to do to the United States? We have a powerful navy. What powerful navy does Britain have? And it has reached a 17th century level. For example, this comes from a report published by Fiona Hill. It was initially a classified report from December. Since Starmer did not respond, she declassified it somehow and published it in The Spectator. No more, no less. I went through that report on my channel. I could hardly believe it contained real facts. But it really seemed to be true. Are you keeping an eye on the time, Stas?
No. Someone called me. I just told them I was busy. Well, that was just a message. Great. I'm all ears.
What makes the report interesting is that it was prepared not only by Fiona Hill, but also by a former British Deputy Minister of Defense, who is also Chief of Staff of the Army. He, incidentally, recently again issued very unpleasant criticism of Starmer for his indecisiveness, and one of Britain's army generals. They were three very competent people. In December, they wrote the following, that the British defense budget is already short by £25 billion to cover current needs. Moreover, the British artillery has only 14 howitzers left for the whole of Britain, because the other 17 howitzers are all that Britain has.
14, I missed that. Damn, that is a guard regiment. I meant to say, it is not even a regiment. Wait a second, it is a battery. No, it's a company.
Well, the fact remains. Competent people wrote that they had a bit of a meltdown in December. It turned out they have only 148 tanks.
Oh, I know that, yes.
That 148 includes Challenger 2s, but also older models. The same report says Poland now has three times as many.
Poland, which they had been laughing at all this time. But there is more. It is not just about the number of tanks. Some are what they call hangar queens, tanks that are stripped for parts to keep others running.
Yes.
They just strip them, cannibalism of equipment.
Exactly. Britain, remember, sent its Challenger 2 tanks to Ukraine. They were kept off the front for a long time, but things got so bad that those tanks somehow ended up at the front. Or, as far as I can tell, they were not pulled back to the rear in time. And it turned out the Challenger 2 is totally unsuited for modern combat. It is too heavy, too unwieldy, and it has no protection against drones at all. It is simply useless. It's basically a coffin on tracks. What's more, it seems to excel at getting stuck in mud and soft ground. It immediately bottoms out, and you simply cannot pull it out.
No Western tank is built for heavy black soil. Our tanks have trouble getting through that. Our tanks are around 45 tons, while that vehicle is over 70. Yes, you are absolutely right. And narrow tracks, too. They have narrow tracks, you know. Nothing has changed in this since 1939.
What do you mean by narrow tracks? You start the engine, the tracks dig two ruts in soft ground. The tank bottoms out and cannot move. That is how it turns into a long-term firing position.
Right? A bunker, just a pillbox.
And actually, how did Starmer's government react to that report? Starmer's finance minister, Rachel Reeves, said she will not give the report's authors or the military a single penny until 2030. Not a single one. She said, there is no money in the budget anyway. Britain's budget is in deficit. Moreover, Britain has an absolutely horrific situation with repayments on existing loans. Britain pays twice as much on loan repayments as its defense budget. Can you imagine? Well, the United States is getting to that point too. Exactly.
There it is now, 1-to-1. No, 1.5-to-1. Next year it'll be 1-to-1, because the budget will grow to $1.5 trillion.
Exactly, yes. But by then, the United States debt payments will have risen too.
Because the debt will grow a lot as well.
And you, Stas, know as well as I do that Britain, unlike the United States, cannot print pounds the way you can print dollars.
Well, they can, but the results would be different.
Yes, that is what we are talking about. Technically, printing them is not hard, but the consequences would be different. The United States can afford to print unbacked dollars. Well, it cannot anymore either. The consequences have already begun. You are talking about efficiency, Stas, of course.
Yes, but it is not the same as Britain, of course.
If Britain starts printing pounds the same way the Federal Reserve prints dollars, then the pound would collapse much faster than would happen to the dollar. Of course. In that case, they might as well print pounds in perforated rolls to use as toilet paper, you know? Why? 54 meters.
We saw in the Weimar Republic that Marx bundled Deutsche Marks burn very well in boiler rooms. Yes, to use as fuel, exactly.
They burn very well. Not quite, actually. In this situation, since Britain lacks a unified, reliable energy system, they are struggling with wind power, solar panels, and nuclear energy. They, remember, flirted with the green agenda for a long time and began shutting down their nuclear power plants and withdrawing funding. Then they changed their minds and decided to start rebuilding their nuclear plants, but it turned out British expertise in building power stations was lost. And now all contracts are being signed with the French company Électricité de France. A hallmark of Électricité de France is going over budget and taking at least 1.5 times longer to build, and often double. What does that mean? It means that if you expect Électricité de France to build or replace 3 reactors for you in 10 years, in 10 years you will find out those reactors will only come online 5 years later. And for that, you will need to add another 50% of funding on top. Otherwise, it will not work. This is exactly what is happening in Britain right now.
Sasha, I have to pause for a moment. Sorry. This is only the beginning. I am preparing it in English, but if you want, I would like to involve you in the project as well. To write reports on green energy. And frankly, green energy is all a lie. It is far worse for the environment than any conventional energy source. And it is also inefficient. If you are interested, I want to ask you to go over green energy with me, and we will break it down like this. Expensive, inefficient, and with no real prospects.
To get rid of nuclear power.
Yes, I do not consider nuclear energy. The pollution and resource destruction are many times greater than with other sources. If you are interested, we can write those articles.
So, we will have to figure it out. I get it, Stas, we have time and glass, right?
Yes, we have both time and glass. I have a hard stop there, I have another call.
I understand, Stas.
It's like our military political experts are taking time off for the holidays. Everyone thinks they have it easy. Who actually has it easy? You need to read. All that stuff, yeah. All of that is needed. Sasha, thank you very much. Let's get back to this topic. Because right now there is an energy and food crisis here that has hit. It has not yet completely wrecked everything, but the Western elite is deliberately ignoring it. They are even trying very hard to ignore it, as best they can. So, thank you all very much. We are not done with this topic, because it is growing. We will keep opening people's eyes about green energy, because we also have elements trying to push this scam into our economy. All right, Sasha. Have a good evening. Thank you, Sasha. Thanks, everyone. We will be back.
Thank you, Variap.